Now, she's one of the best-known figures in Australian letters, a publisher with agenda-setting titles to her credit, including Louise Milligan's book on Cardinal Pell, titles by politicians including Tony Abbott, the notorious Mark Latham Diaries, and at the other end of the scale, the underworld figure Mick Gatto. We're talking, of course, about Louise Adler, former head of Melbourne University Publishing, who resigned from that position amid some storms earlier this year. She came to publishing after careers as a teacher, arts editor and administrator, and as a broadcaster. She even spawned a verb, to be Adlerized, which has been defined as being talked into something you don't want to do, and then being delighted with the result. Louise Adler, welcome to The Year That Made Me.
Thank you, Hugh.
We'll park your past just for a moment. Tell us, what are your plans for your future?
Oh, well, the plans are, I think my husband, the thespian, would describe this period as resting, but I'm not one for resting, and I'm just thinking about what the future holds. I was delighted, honoured to be offered a Vice Chancellor's Professorial Fellowship at Monash University, which I've accepted. So that's the first project, and I'm thinking about the rest, whether it's in publishing, whether it's broader activities, I don't know yet. But
you're not ruling out publishing.
I'm a chronic publisher, I think. I think it's, every time I see an idea or an individual, I think, oh, there's a book.
It's an interesting instinct, isn't it? Because a publisher, you can just see, obviously you get besieged with people and their own manuscripts, which I imagine can be as tedious as it is exciting. And then in other cases, you'll see someone and go, no, I really want a book out of that person.
Mm. I did really enjoy that process of matching people and ideas or ideas with people. I thought it was wonderful, that opportunity. And it was terrific to see people who would ordinarily not have thought that there was a book in an idea. I mean, one that comes to mind, well, a couple that come to mind immediately would be Mark Colvin, who I think it took me 5 years to persuade him, the late and great Mark Colvin, to think about writing his memoirs. And I was so thrilled. I mean, he thought about it. He was sort of reluctant. He was busy. He had a full-time job at the ABC and, of course, serious health issues. And in the end, it was a superb piece of writing. And it was wonderful to have published that in his lifetime. And it's been one of the most successful MUP titles. The other one I think of is Rick Morton, and he had written a piece in the review section of The Australian about the idea of being an outsider. And he was talking about Latham's a sense of himself as being an outsider, and Rick Morton was suggesting that, well, actually, that's not really called outsiderdom when Gough Whitlam carries you on a silk cushion to Paris with you, and that, Rick Morton himself understood perhaps a little bit better what it means to be an outsider. And again, it was someone I sat down and said, look, I think this is a bigger idea and I'd like you to think about it. And 100 Years of Dirt has gone on to be very successful and really resonated with people. So
where did all this come from? You were a bookish girl?
Yes, I think there's a sort of it's a stereotype, the asthmatic, slightly frail child who spends most of Melbourne's winters in bed and had chronic asthma, and what else was there to do but read novels? My parents were cultured, intellectual, committed to the ideas of reading, learning, education. Basically, I spent my childhood reading and away from school a lot of it, and it was where that pleasure in the book, the intimacy of the book, the pleasure in the narrative came from, I think.
And it's interesting because you've published so much non-fiction, and yet it was interesting you said there that your formative reading experiences were the novel. What is, particularly for a young, thoughtful, emerging adult, how important are novels in terms of expanding worlds rather than, the non-fiction study?
Well, I have to confess that you wouldn't probably call my own personal reading habits or appetites particularly expansive. I was devoted to Ina Blyton's The Naughtiest Girl at Mallory Towers. I was determined to go to boarding school. My parents, of course, would not have a bar of it, but I just thought that was absolutely marvellous. Just remember very vividly coming to the table one day, the dinner table, and saying to my parents, my father, who'd come from Paris in 1949 and my mother from Berlin in 1939, saying, oh, goody, lashings of potatoes. And my father... although he was a very gentle character, saying to my mother, I can't stand it. And he went to my bedroom and removed the library of Ina Blyton novels that I had. And I sort of started weeping and saying, well, what am I going to read? What am I going to read? And he said, here you go. And he gave me Leon Uris's Miller 18 and The Last of the Maccabees by Howard Fast. Mm. And that was the end of my childish reading and the beginning of my reading of serious novels.
Did you take to those world. Immediately? Did you take?
I did. I could feel the kind of richness and the kind of complexity of the narratives. And I just, that was my pleasure, was reading. It was also, of course, television. You know, this was the beginning of television and I did enjoy Perry Mason and his, you know, his successor, Ironside, things like that. The Donna Reed Show, that was the era. You know, Father Knows Best. So there was a sort of bit of popular culture, but most of it was quite elevated, if you like.
How do you reflect now on your parting from Melbourne University Publishing?
Well, I think I had the privilege of working at MUP with the most brilliant team for 15 years. I think we transformed the press into a modern 21st century publishing business. I think we published some genuinely important books and made a real contribution to public culture. And so I'm sort of very proud of what we did. And along the way, I had a brilliant time. It was a huge amount of fun.
Now, you name as the year that made you 1973. Why that year?
Because that's the year I went to Israel. I left high school, did my year 12 or matriculation as it was called then, and I went to Israel and that was utterly transformational from the newness of white Australia, middle class Australia, what was white Australia, I'm not talking about Indigenous Australia, I'm talking about white Australia. As a 17-year-old going to Israel, I thought it would be a socialist utopia. I thought that everybody would be dancing around the campfire on the tarmac at Lod Airport, which of course it wasn't quite like that. But it was absolutely exciting. Tough. I was going to say brutal, but it wasn't brutal, but it was tough. It was another place. The Middle East is another country altogether from, you know, Melbourne, suburban Melbourne. It was a shock to realise that there were class and ethnic divides brutally present in Israel. The plight of the Palestinians was as powerful as, and depressingly remains such, but it was still an extraordinarily exciting place for a young person who went to university there.
And there was a war. There was a Yom Kippur war was about that time. Did you see evidence of that?
I did indeed. Well, that came at the end of that year, about October. The Yom Kippur War broke out in October of that year, and I had already been at university, at the Hebrew University there, and that was very shocking. That's the sort of shocking end of, if you like, of the experience. Suddenly the streets are desolate and the supermarket's shelves are completely clear of anything, all everything, milk, bread, eggs, everything is gone. You see the panic. You see that the country knows and understands war, not just the wars of Israel since, you know, 1948, but, you know, the Holocaust, the Second World War, that it's a country deeply etched and deeply shaped by the sense of war and the trauma of war. And I'm not talking now about, I'm talking about what happens within the state of Israel. I'm not talking about the terrible, tragic impasse that exists now and existed even then in 1973, the lack of resolution of a just peace for both Israelis and Palestinians, which remains the great, tragedy of the Middle East from my point of view. But that October in 1973 was very shocking for someone like me who'd come from, you know, sunny Melbourne, middle-class Melbourne, and suddenly the streets were absolutely deserted, eerily quiet. And I've always remembered this brief, tiny moment of walking across from Haratzofim, the Mount Scopus, and walking to the next hill to catch a bus, and nobody was around. And this 15-year-old Arab boy approached me, and I was waiting for the bus stop, and just reached out and grabbed my breast. And it was a really shocking moment. It wasn't that it was traumatic. It wasn't a rape of any sort at all. It's no more than really felt like a spasm of anger on his part, a symbolic gesture of impotent rage. And I'd never forgotten it. And he moved away, he went about his business, but in that isolation, it felt like it symbolised everything, with the hearing the tanks in the background rolling along off to the Jordanian border. And it was an eerie moment, and a moment of impasse and anger and impotence, really. But the other memory I have, although there were lots of memories, there's a day of, it's called Yom HaShoah, the Day of Remembrance, and it's about the Holocaust and other wars, of course. Everybody, the whole country comes to a standstill. People get out of their cars and stand next to them for 2 minutes while air raid sirens, you know, blast that sound, which is in itself so chilling. And you have a sense that this is a place that's full of history, that it's beset and besieged by tragedy and by war and by, you know, all of that. It's very hard to talk about, but it's a remarkable place.
Your song is what song?
Well, it's a very melancholy song because I do have a little melancholy side to myself. It's a heart-rending aria from Henry Purcell's opera, Dido and Aeneas, and it's called Dido's Lament. So Dido, she's abandoned by her Trojan hero, Aeneas, so she has a pyre built and sets it on fire, and she wants Aeneas to see from his ship that she has killed herself. And I guess why I wanted this song, and I've long adored it, I mean, I do love a soprano, and I laid both my parents to rest in the past 18 months. And so the exhortation to remember those we've loved and who have loved us moves me greatly.
It is beautiful music. Louise Adler, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The doomed, despairing Dido, When I'm Laid in Earth by Henry Purcell, the song chosen by my guest for the year that made me, Louise Adler.